The internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.
Teachings in the Air with Sahil Thit, a.k.a. Gerald Oldman. Today's podcast is titled Resilience and Perseverance. Not a day goes by that Sahil Thit needs to be resilient and to persevere. You know, resilience means that the ability to recover quickly after being traumatized, being wounded, being cut. And you know, for a good part of my life, I would say I was in trauma prison. You know, because I was cut and wounded by abuse and by history, you know, what I'd see or hear in the air and feel. And had been cut. And there was not a healing for it. You know, the wounds from racism, oppression, violence that come from the colonization process in this country had me living what I call a victim life. Because victims of trauma, generally speaking, are angry, depressed, or anxiety-ridden, fearful, fear of making mistakes, fear of failure, fear of rejection. You know, I was living that life, that victim life. It wasn't 24/7. I had instances of extreme joy and feeling accepted and part of in my life. But underneath all of that, some would say the skeletons in the closet, I had that trauma. So when people aren't treated for trauma, it results of an individual being unhealthy, not sound in the body. When I think of the numbers of diabetes in our population, indigenous population, heart disease, you know, all of those sicknesses that are preventable. It's a sad picture. You know, on the mind, you know, and we're angry and negative. It's not good for the children to see. It's not good in our own body. You know, they say that if you're stressed out all the time, it could lead to heart disease or, you know, have problems with your heart, your blood pressure. And of course, then it's our spirit, my spirit, that's holding my body together. I lost that will to be successful. Or to pursue dreams is a better way of saying it. But when you're successful at everything you do, your life is good. That means you do your best, you do a good job, you start, you finish. So the logical result with our people that were not treated for trauma was unhealthy families and communities. You know, broken families, scattered families. You know, we can't deny that exists in our family, in our community. You know, and it took me a long time because I would say, why are we this way? How come? Why so much suicide, violence, addictions, poverty? You know, that narrative. And then over time, you know, I learned the history of this country and learned that there were people before I was even born, probably before my dad and grandfather's time, that talked about our people as the Indian problem. And these ones that were talking like that were totally in love with power. They wanted wealth, individual wealth, individual ownership of land. So they come up with solutions to get to those resources, the gold, the trees, the salmon, the farmlands, you know, agricultural lands. They come up with a solution. And the solution of reservations, lands reserved for Indians, tiny little tracts of land on this continent, in the least desirable places, taken away from lakefront property, oceanfront property, you know, right across the land. And the other part of the solution was to take the children and put them into residential schools and also Indian day schools and start to assimilate them, take them away from their language, their rituals, their ceremonies that kept us healthy for thousands of years. So segregation was their plan. We did not ask for reservations or residential schools or Indian day schools. You know, and a part of us in that solution too was to lock us out of the economy. No, we're on the reserve. When they first started, you have to have permission even to leave the reserve from the Indian agent. And if you're going to sell something, you needed permission from the Indian agent. So we're on these small tracts of land called reservations. So we do not have access to resources. I learned this firsthand from my dad. We're driving on our reservation. And I seen this sawdust piles and some crumbling structures. I said, what's that? He says, oh, your uncle's had a sawmill there. I said, oh. And he says, yes, they were cutting ties for the railroad, Pacific Great Eastern. It was just coming in through our territory. They were cutting ties and selling them to the railroad. I asked my father, why isn't it running now? Why did it stop? He says they couldn't get trees. They're going to go off the reserve to get trees. They're horse loggers, pulling logs out by horse. And they were told to stop, that they needed a permit to cut those trees from Crown land. So they went to get a permit, and all the timber was spoken for by big companies. So it's proof we're locked out of the economy. You know, so that's the reservation. And it became like a lawless society. something would happen between humans, as they do all over the world. If you got a justice system or a system to deal with it, then you deal with it. Well, Canada was to take care of us. What they were, it's like they put us in a res and left us there. So, as a result, we have a lot of unfinished business between families, in the families, on the res. The conflict resolution that we used to use was not there now. So before contact, we're very healthy populations, strong in mind, body, and spirit. We had a way of life. There was a justice system, education system. And in those systems, allowed us to have a sustainable way of life. That means it's the same year after year. Plenty of salmon, game like deer and moose, food, because of our laws, our policies about resource extraction, resource use of water. So we're very healthy. And now it's not uncommon to hear some of our leaders say, we're in a state of emergency. We're now in crisis, and crisis means a turning point. Where it seems we're turning to negative. So in the res, or I'll just say with people, indigenous people, all of a sudden there's addictions, violence, abuse, broken families. We became sickly. And for some, I don't know how many, but I suspect a good number, life had become hateful to them. As a result, we're overrepresented in suicide, overdose, accidents, ill health. That's what happened from segregation, from being locked out of the economy. And of course, you know, we were also seen as inferior to the European peoples. There's something wrong with us, in that way they could do what they want. You know, so I grew up in this. You know, it wasn't until I was probably 25 that I started to learn the shared history of Canadians and my people, the Stadtlium people. And of course, I became angry when I learned about the reservation, about the residential school, day schools, because I was part of it, all of it. So I had that period of life of just being angry and skeptical, you know, a feeling of no hope. And, you know, in my growing up life, I got into reading about history. I loved reading about history so much that I wanted to become a history teacher. You know, even though I didn't know any way to where to get to do that. In my reading, all of a sudden I started to, you know, acquire role models, teachers, gurus. Guru means someone that brings the light, you know. Because I was reading all kinds of books that, you know, as a teenager, and a young adult, I learned a statement, freedom fighters, people fighting to preserve a way of life. I started to develop this list of people that I admired. Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, Pontiac, Shea, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, Gandhi, Dan George, Chief Dan George, and Nelson Mandela. Oh, there's another one from Mexico, El Zapata. So all of these ones, you know, were out there. Well, the ones that were there when I was young, and my was Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, Gandhi, Nelson Mandela. So I hear about Nelson Mandela, about this man in South Africa that had been in prison for 27 years. I started to learn about apartheid in South Africa. And I learned, as I become politicized with Statlium, indigenous way of life with Canada, one of my teachers said the apartheid system in South Africa was modeled after how Canada segregated indigenous people onto reservations, and that they needed a pass to leave the reservation. And that's what townships were in South Africa. And then in 1995, I guess shortly after Nelson became the leader, first black leader of South Africa, well, there were many leaders before in their system. But in the modern, I guess you could say South Africa, and there was an education conference at BCIT where I was working, British Columbia Institute of Technology. And there were representatives there from South Africa. And I got to speak to one of the representatives, a South African woman. So I said, "You meet Nelson?" And she says, "No, but I was in a big conference hall and he was the speaker." And she said, "Nelson talked to us, thanked us for our hard work, and said, I come today to ask you to do 14 hours a day now for a while." And she said, everybody in the hall stood up and said, "Yes, Nelson." And I think, whoa, you know, and I'm impressed. And I asked her, I said, "You know, I wondered, I heard of Nelson Mandela being in prison on Robben Island for 27 years. And I asked her, I said, how did he maintain himself, his resilience?" And she said, "Oh, we have a belief in South Africa that Robben Island and the prison he was in happened to be one of the power spots on the planet Earth, in a sense of powerful healing spot, that they're around the planet." And she said, "That's why he stayed Nelson Mandela." I said, "Oh, I believe that." So after that, there was a documentary about fighting apartheid in one of the little cinemas in Vancouver. It was over 3 nights. It was such a long documentary. But there I'd learned that Nelson and his group knew they were going to be sent to prison. So they appointed some of their members to go overseas and to tell the people about apartheid, to start an anti-apartheid movement out of South Africa. And I had learned that they had done that and they were successful. An example Fuji Films was providing the films for the identity badges that the South Africans had to wear in the townships. They all had to have these identity badges. So they boycotted. They boycotted Granny Smith apples. They boycotted rugby matches where South Africa was playing. It was such a well-done documentary. Really clear what could happen when people are committed and clear in their communication. So they're fighting apartheid. My wife said she wrote a letter to stop apartheid when she was in university. You know, it shows it like it's, I imagine, like a wind going around the planet, alerting everyone about apartheid in South Africa. And another place of my learning about South Africa was a novel, The Power of One, by Bryce Courtenay. And I got the feel of oppression from that book. And of course, you know, today I know, at that time I knew barely anything about life in South Africa. So I've been blessed that I can travel. In 2022, my wife and I went to South Africa. You know, we landed in Johannesburg, and it's a big city in South Africa. And of course, you know, every chance I get, I'll read a brochure, I'll look at things about the history. Sometimes I Google it, you know, but this time I've seen some. That Johannesburg started because of the gold in them thar hills, and also diamonds. And it reminded me of my homeland, where I'm from, my community. There was one of the largest gold deposits for a while. Right where we hunted and fished. And that's why there is a town of Lillooet. That's why there's Victoria, Vancouver. Because they started these centers where the resources would flow through, were actually dug up out of the ground. So that's Johannesburg. Then my wife and I went to do a little tour of the animals, what they call the Big Five. And what struck me was that this camp that we're at, they take us out in jeeps to look at animals, birds, creatures in South Africa. That the camp was totally run by indigenous South Africans. And I felt so at home, that they were like us, you know. They would, one of the younger, I don't know if even younger, but one of the men there would address my wife as auntie. We're out on the tour, and then we stopped, and there was a little barbecue, and they were handing out skewers of sausages and different proteins, you know. And he gave her one, and she took one. And he comes back again with more. She says, "No, no, no, I'm done." And she said, and he says, "Please, Auntie, just take one more, you know." It reminded me of our community. So I could call them uncle, auntie, niece. No problem. And they were so friendly. Such wonderful smiles. You know. Yeah. I saw the giraffe, the rhino, the lion, the leopard, the ears of a hippopotamus. You know, and many kinds of deer-like creatures. You know, the hyena. All these different animals. in their habitat. And we seen two men were out early in the morning, and they were walking. And our guide said there were guardians of the animals, especially the rhino. And we'd, because we seen a rhinoceros, a big creature, birds all over it. I'd see birds crawling right in the ear. And we seen this rhinoceros didn't have its horn. And they said they cut it off so the poachers wouldn't kill it. And I says, oh. And these men were out all night guarding the animals. Indigenous South African men. Yeah, so after we left there, we go back to Johannesburg. Then we go for a tour. You know, the tour of Constitution Hill. You know, and that's where I see this prison. And we're going through the prison and I see Mandela Gandhi's name in big letters on the wall, outside wall of the prison. And that's where I learned that Mandela and Gandhi were in this prison together. You know, in that prison, they had videos, and we had a tour guide, and the cruelty of that place, it just saddened me to hear what happened there to those people, the South Africans. You know, it's what humanity can do, eh? Not all of humanity. I need to keep reminding myself. I've come to believe there's very few that are that cruel, but somehow they gain power. And we're in Soweto. Went to this memorial museum. And it was to honor the youth who gave their lives in the struggle for freedom and democracy in South Africa. There's a name on the wall, Hector Peterson. And we had a guide walking us around the memorial museum, because there were buildings and there were plazas. And he told us about Hector Peterson. He said the adults, the parents in South Africa were going to demonstrate because the South African, which were Dutch peoples, were making the law where all of the language in the school was to be South African, which is made up of Dutch and other languages. And the parents said, no, we don't want that. We want our children in our language. So they were going to do big demonstrations in South Africa. And the high school students in Soweto, of course, listened to their parents. And how they decided, I don't know. And there's leadership in high school groups, too. I was just imagining these young high school students said, we're going to demonstrate, too. But we won't do it in the same day. We're going to have a two-day demonstration. We'll leave the schools and we'll demonstrate. And so they went out to demonstrate. And Hector Peterson was 12 years old, was in a student demonstration. The police opened fire on the students. And Hector Peterson was shot and collapsed. And another South African man seen him and picked him up and was running with him. And a journalist, a South African indigenous journalist, snapped a picture of it, of this man carrying Hector Peterson. And the man ran with him to get him to medical attention to see if they could save his life. but Hector Peterson.